This is Spectrum.
Alternative medicine, homeopathy, secret society, hypnosis, the paranormal, alternative energy, UFO abduction, the weird, the wild, and the wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Well, we're going to be doing a special interview before our interview with Ed Pouchet, with Richard Dolan. Richard Dolan's got some interesting news, some exciting news, something he's going to be doing, and I'd just like to bring on Richard to get him to talk about it. Richard Dolan, welcome.
Hi, Scott. Ed, thanks. Great to be on your show. Thank you.
Okay, so you've got a new project you're starting. It looks like you're starting it soon, so if you could tell us about that.
Gladly. I'm doing something that actually I've been wanting to do, I'm thinking about doing for many years, and that's having my own radio show. It's internet radio. And that will actually be starting this coming Saturday night, 8 o'clock Eastern time. It's a 3-hour show. So it goes from 8 to 11 every Saturday night Eastern time. I'm calling it Truth Out Radio Live with Richard Dolan. And there's a couple of things about this show that I think will be a little bit different than most other shows, particularly those in the alternative even paranormal type of radio community. Mm-hmm. One, it's 3 hours. It's not a 2-hour, but a 3-hour show, so it's a little longer. The other thing is that really it's going to be something that I will probably have guests on from time to time. I tell you that that's not ever going to be the primary focus of this show. It's really my opportunity to do my thing once a week. It give me the chance to talk about items that are interesting to me, whether they're regarding UFO research, UFO events, or non-UFO related things, just having to do with politics or anything else that really suits my fancy. It's going to be a very personalized kind of a show, and a little bit will be very structured, but some of it will be just going on the fly, and we'll see how that works out.
Okay.
The other thing I should mention is we've got it set up. This is with the Global Radio Alliance. This is a very new sort of network, and I'm really excited to be with these guys. But we've got it set up that we'll have a nice toll-free number, so we'll be able to take call-ins. Maybe not the first show. We're actually just hustling to get everything together, but that really will be the norm. And I am hoping that we'll be able to get lots of callers that it'll be kind of a nice community that develops between myself and the people listening into the show.
Okay, you're gonna have call-ins. Are you also gonna have like a chat feature where people can run and do text chat?
Yes, absolutely. We've got a nice chat room already, good to go, and all of this will be through Global Radio Alliance. I'll have links from my sites, and I'm sure word eventually will get out from wherever. But we got the chat room good. We've got a really good chat moderator, a lady who's had a lot of experience previously doing this, I'm told. So I've got some very good feelings about it. I want a show that's very interactive with listeners. At the same time, I want to be able to have a show that will give me a chance to have my own little platform, my own little soapbox, so I can get my own little happy rants out there from time to time.
Yeah, that's great.
Why not?
Yeah, it's great.
I've done so many radio interviews over the years, and, honestly, it's at the point where I think that I'm a pretty easy guy for most people to interview. This is the impression that I get. That's what I'm told. Really, just wind me up and I'll just go. I can just go. And I could go, Scott, for 3 hours. I could go for 5 hours if I really needed to. But thank God, I don't want to do that to people. So if we have a 3-hour show once a week, I think that'll be quite sufficient.
Yeah, I think one of the benefits that you're going to have in this situation is that I've noticed you're a comprehensive thinker. And by that, I mean you can go after any subject and have a good knowledgeable opinion on it. And because you're not just Richard Dolan, the UFO guy, you are that. But having talked to you, I know that you know a great deal about a lot of other subjects. So this, I think, is gonna be very beneficial.
Well, thank you so much for that. I will say I have spent my entire life as a student of many, many different things. And long before I studied UFOs, I was a very serious student of history in a variety of subjects. I did a lot of European history, German and Russian history, U.S. history, U.S. diplomatic history. And in the last decade, I've studied the whole gamut of ancient history. I've just got a very strong interest in science. I am not a scientist by any means, but I certainly read many science books, and I like to think that I'm up to date on many of the current issues in science and technology and everything else is out there. I have a very inquisitive, curious type of mind. I hope that I never lose that. I turned 50 years old this summer, Scott. I look back on my life and I think this type of an endeavor where I get a chance to just talk with people about matters that are of interest to me, I think really could be a good opportunity. It could work. I've had a number of people give me very positive feedback on this idea for a show, and I'm hopeful that it'll get off to a good start and that it'll get only better every week. I'm sure there's going to be bumps along the way.
I'm sure it'll be fine.
Things I haven't expected. There's always something that you don't expect that comes up and throws a wrench in there. But I have a very good sense of optimism about this show, and I'm definitely looking forward to it. It's Global Radio Alliance. Two gentlemen starting it up, Race Hobbs and Royce Fitzgerald, both in Arkansas. Really great guys. I met Race about a year ago at a conference where I was speaking. In fact, that was at the Ozark UFO conference. Very much hit it off with him and his lovely wife, Robin, and got to know Royce as well. I like what they have to do. I like what they have to say about this show. And again, they just offered me the opportunity to do it, and I thought, perfect. I'll do it on two conditions, I said. One is that I get a three-hour show, and two, that I simply have full reign about how this show will be in terms of the format, and that's what it is.
Okay. Are you going to be having commercials, or is it just going to be 3 hours of Richard?
Thankfully, there will be some break time.
Okay. Sometimes when a comprehensive thinker gets going, you know, gets rolling, right, you don't want to stop them. You just, you got to be careful with that.
That's nice. There will be breaks. I think, there'll be a break at the top of the hour. That'll be, I think, something like close to 10 minutes or seven minutes, I think they said. I don't even know, actually. It's like a 7 or 8 or 9 minute break. And there'll be two other sets of breaks, I think 20 minutes and at 40 minutes or roughly thereabouts, there'll be breaks. They want to get commercial.
So many years of radio. Of course, you've done so many years of radio that breaks are something that you're very used to. You're used to sort of looping your what you need to say into a time frame.
Yes, that's something you learn. I learned that more, to be honest with you, from doing video interviews than anything else. I think it was 5 years ago. God, it's going back in time. I did a television show for the Sci-Fi Network called Sci-Fi Investigates. I learned a lot on that experience, I will tell you, because really it was an NBC-produced show, and they flew me around the country. I had a lot of good food that summer, I recall, all the NBC time. Drank my share of margaritas as well. But one thing that they really emphasize is the importance of being able to say what you have to say as concisely as possible. When you're doing radio, it's really the same thing. You can wax poetic, I suppose, and get off on various tangents, but you've got to be able to wrap it up when you get down to that break time.
Yeah, you can't go too far off into a tangent because you only have limited time before you need to loop out and come to a conclusion or at least answer the question.
Well, the other thing is I think of speaking as I think about writing, which is that readers have limited time. I don't want to waste someone's time with a whole wad of BS if they've got other things to do. So you have X amount of words that you need to use to make your point. And with speaking, really, it's the same thing. You've got a certain amount of time to make your point. Make your point. Let's get to it. That's always been my way anyway. So I don't think it's going to be any different on this show.
Okay. Are you going to be talking about UFOs? This is an excellent opportunity for people that have read your books, and maybe they have some questions in that they would want answered, that they could call in and they could say, Richard, I read your book and there was this point here. Could you expand on that a little? So it'd be a good opportunity for people like that?
Sure. Absolutely. I'll talk about as many UFO cases as is interesting. I don't ever want the show to be tedious. We'll talk about sightings. I'll talk about current news. I'll talk about state of UFO research or alternative community research, which I think in my last interview with you, that was certainly something that we touched on, and that remains an interest of mine, as well as basic political type issues, things that are going on with the developing national security empire that is the United States, that is the nascent world government, new world order, whatever we want to call it. All of these are concerns of mine. All of these will be things that will be coming up, I'm sure, on a weekly basis.
All right. Okay. Well, look forward to it, guys. It looks like it's coming this Saturday. That's March 31st will be his first show. And what time is your start time?
It'll be 8 o'clock Eastern, and that'll go for 3 hours, so it'll be from 8 to 11 Eastern time. And again, that will be with the Global Radio Alliance. The name of my show is now, I've just named it, it's called Truth Out Radio. And I guess the best link, though, would be globalradioalliance.com.
Okay. Anybody wants to check out the link to Richard's show, Richard's radio show, they can go to the upcoming guest section. Tomorrow they'll be able to go to the archive section. Just click on the link that I will provide in there. That'll take you right to the site where he's going to have his show. It's this Saturday night, March 31st at 8 p.m. Eastern. Of course, I'm sure you're going to have to put all of the time zones in there on your website.
Hey, yes.
Richard? You're going to have to put all the, have to break it down to all the different time zones, get one for over in Europe and the whole bit.
Well, I suppose. I mean, look, can't people just figure it out? Do the math. Do the math, people.
Oh, that's brilliant. Okay, that's great. I appreciate talking to you. We'll talk again, you know.
Oh, absolutely. I always enjoy chatting with you, whether on or off the air, to be honest with you. We have fun.
Yeah, I really do. Thank you. And well, that was very interesting talking to Richard Dolan about his upcoming radio show. Right now, though, we have Edgar Fouché, retired U.S. Air Force and defense contractor, with us tonight. He is the author of the book Alien Rapture and a special guest on AlienScientist.com forum. Edgar, or Ed as his friends call him, came out and made his first disclosure back in 1998. He was the first one to describe how the TR-3B flying triangle, or ASTRA, and its purpose, as well as other classified aircraft and technology. His sole purpose is to get information out to people, and he is not promoting or selling anything. Hello, Ed.
Yes, hello, Scott.
How you doing? Nice to talk to you.
Well, it's always fun to talk to you.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you a bit of your history, your military history, the sort of events that happened leading up to the writing of Alien Rapture, and what you got you involved in all of that. So what was it in your past, just as a quick outline for your military history leading up to all of these events, and quite possibly, I remember stories in the book that were of there were younger events involved. The lead character, I would assume, is you.
Yes, I'm Joe Green.
You're Joe Green. Okay. So there is events as a young boy that happened with Joe Green, and so maybe we'll have to go back further.
the story leading up to Joe Green as the adult in the book has a lot of backstory about when he was a child. And I've had a lot of just weird and unexplainable things happen throughout my life, especially growing up. And I really have never talked about it in public until recently on my Be Fearful YouTube channel. I started disclosing these tales because I didn't want to confuse people with my public speaking, talking about black technology and secret programs. And I didn't want to confuse people with thinking, well, he's just another alien nut. And I'm not. I mean, I assume there are aliens. I very strongly assume that. But I didn't want my story about talking about the flying triangle and other vehicles and technology to be confused with strange experiences I had as a child. For example, in the book, I talk about little Joe Green down in Georgia in the early morning hours before sunset out trying to shoot rabbits in the cornfield, and then the sun came up from the wrong direction. There was this huge, bright orb, which at the time I assumed was the sun. And then I blacked out, and, right after sunset, my uncle, Junior, came looking for me, and I was standing there just staring to the west, and he grabbed me and shook me, and I never did recall exactly what happened. In fact, for many, many years, I had suppressed most of my childhood memories. So when I first started talking to my friends, we met out in Las Vegas in the early 90s, and we were talking about different black programs, and I happened to mention the triangle, and of course every one of them knew about it, and we really were very upset with the government for suppressing technology that would revolutionize energy and make power more available at a cheaper cost, and the flight characteristics of the magnetic field disruptor that would also revolutionize transportation. So they agreed, since I was the only writer in the group, that I would outline the stories and pick their testimony and work it into the book. And they also introduced me to a few of their friends that wouldn't talk over the phone, and back then, we really didn't have hardly any internet, so I would travel around the country and talk to her, interview these people, and so I would start building the story from that point. And then we got to the point where I had a draft, and I added the backstory, the character Joe Green, was the protagonist, the star of the book, so to speak. And,
yeah.
So we started adding this backstory of my own personal happenings, because Joe Green is kind of a haunted person that has these visions and interactions with these voices in his head, and these turns out to be aliens, and they're kind of his mentor and bring him through a kind of a transition period. So we ended up having a story put together loosely around 95. And then in 96, I contacted Bob Silverstein, Quicksilver Literary Agency, and he was excited about the book. And he said, well, you're an unknown, so, and you also need a little polish to your book. He says, I'm going to recommend Brad Steigerman, your co-author. Well, back then, I didn't care if I gave away half the book to a co-author, because I didn't do it for the money. My sole purpose was to get the information out there.
Right.
And I had talked to several judge, advocate, general lawyers to know exactly, you know, where that gray line was I didn't want to step across. And then their advice was, if I told people it was secondhand information or thirdhand, and then I wrote it as fiction, I could pretty damn well much write, you know, whatever I wanted.
Right, that's true. So the characters in the book, they're based on, all of the characters in the book are based on people that you know, and these original people that you were met and had talked to and were angry about the suppression of the technology that should be out in the public.
Yes, there are a couple exceptions. The background officers, like at Groom Air Base, were fictional. One was General Buharness, was mostly a composite of Colonel Sullivan, one of the greatest officers that I ever served under. The wife and kid were fictional. Agabar, the torturer, was actually a composite of different stories I heard from CIA friends about how they had trained these interrogators for South America and European countries and in the School of Americas, I believe it was, and other places. So the stories about Agabar, the torturer, although I believe were true, he was not a real person.
Right.
However, the NSA assassin, M.D. Crawford, was a real person I knew most my adult life from the time I went in the military. His real name was Michael Crawford.
Oh, okay.
And the funny thing about him, he, even though he did the dirty work for the agency, I'm sure there were others like him. He's the only one I knew that did that type of work. He thought he was a super patriot, and he felt like somebody's got to do the dirty work.
And when you say them. That, you mean wet work.
Yes, well.
Assassinations.
Yes. That he felt like somebody, you know, needed to do that to protect America, and he did not see himself as a killer or murderer. He had a job, and he was extremely good at it. Of course, everybody I talked to about him, you know, thought basically he was made up. And then one day after Rebecca and I got married in 96, a guy calls up on the phone. He goes, who's this? And she says, well, who's calling? And he says, it's none of your business. This is, where's Ed? He says, well, she says, well, I'm Ed's wife. And he said, hell, I didn't know he got remarried. So anyway, Rebecca Braves walks into my study, and I pick up the extension, and I pointed to her to stay on, and we started talking. And then at some point, she realized that M.D. Crawford in the book was the guy I was talking to. And her jaw just literally dropped to the ground, and he wanted a draft of the book. And I got his current address and told him I'd send it to him, and he says, did you use my name in the book? And I said, no, I use M.D. Crawford. And he says, well, I want you to use my real name. And I said, I can't do that. Lawyers won't let me do that. And I said, why on earth would you want somebody to know your real name? He says, because I want my daughters and grandkids to know that I was a patriot. And, of course, you know, to me, that was very odd. And his interpretation of what he did. So only recently have I started talking about real names, like Jerry Elric, who was one of my friends that gave me information. He got up a couple years ago. He was 54, I think. Went to the bathroom, died of heart attack. And then there was Bob Cullen, Allied Signal Bendix, that I first met at Edwards and then Nellis. He was a rep, factory rep. And he gave me information on some of these black programs. And he called me up one afternoon and says, Ed, I've been having all this numbness and tingling and blurred vision. And I went to the doctor, and I've got a brain tumor on my brain stem, and they can't operate or do chemo. So from the time he started having the symptoms to the night he died, I was the last one that talked to him on the phone before he passed away that night. In less than a month, he was dead. There was also Paige Gray from ITT, based out of Nutley, New Jersey. And same thing happened to him. He was in perfect health. started getting sicker, went to the hospital, died within a week.
And again, these are characters that you wrote in this book.
They're characters that fed me information, plus I used composites of some of their personalities and personalities in the book.
Right, okay.
For example, there was a classified dive I was on when I was stationed in Okinawa to retrieve the equipment code books off a sunken Russian trawler. And Russian trawlers are notorious spy ships loaded with radar and intercept and communications equipment. One went down in a storm, and then the NSA satellites tracked it, and we went on a dive and to drop transponders so that once we located it, the submarine could go in there with a deep submersible and start retrieving equipment. Now, the head of the dive team was also in charge of FIBAS, Foreign Broadcast Intelligence Service. The NSA always called it Information Service, but it was actually, the NSA name was Foreign Broadcast Intelligence Service. And the guy that was in charge there, his name was Rostislav Yukov. Now, in the book, I call him Cherkov, but everything about him was the real Rostislav Yukov. And he was a white Russian, a defector, I think from either Georgia or Ukraine, and his grandfather was a famous Russian general, and he was, Rostislav was in charge of the dive. And then there's one person, Owen McKeon, on the book, which is actually a composite of two people. One of the people was a CIA friend, and the other person was an SR-71 pilot. So the Owen and McKeon are actually two personalities kind of merged. And then, of course, M.D. Crawford on the dive was Michael Crawford. So, you know, these, like I said, these are, these characters in the book are either composites of people I knew, in a couple of cases, people I heard about. When Joe Green gets to Medina Lake in San Antonio to talk to Dr. Farr, well, the real doctor's name was Parr.
Okay.
Worked at Southwest Research. And he did have a cabin. I've been in it exactly where we talk about. It's loaded with high-tech equipment. Almost everything that I wrote about, and when Joe Green returned to San Antonio to talk to Farr at Medina Lake, it's almost 100% accurate, except for Crawford showing up as the assassin to kill Dr. Farr. That was the only thing that was made up. I mean, you can actually go out there and look at the same place. It's still there.
Okay, so there was an event in the book. Now, of course, some of the listeners who haven't read Alien Rapture won't understand the characters we're talking about, but everybody who has absolutely will. Just maybe back up a bit and talk about some of the military work that you did, some of the programs that you worked on in the military, and describe your military career, and then we'll sort of shoot back to the book and the characters in it.
In 1967, I was in Kilgore College in East Texas. I graduated from Longview High School near there. In February 67 was the biggest draft month in since World War II, and I believe it was like 42,000 people were drafted. I was drafted out of college. I had 5 out of 6 deferments. Back then on the draft, you had a draft board and you had deferments, like if you were married or had a kid, or worked as a defense contractor, or went in college making a C or better average. I had 5 of those 6 deferments. The only deferment I didn't have, I wasn't physically or mentally incapacitated. And the rich kids didn't go. So us middle-class kids did. So the deferments did nothing for me. Now, you know, Dick Cheney, I think, had a cyst on his ass, or that was Rush Limbaugh, or, you know, they got deferments for the slightest things.
Man, they had a hangnail. Oh, look, can't go. Sorry.
No, absolutely, absolutely. So I went to basic training in around June of 67. I had a late enlistment of 3 months. And I volunteer for pararescue. It's the guys that jump out of aircraft, helicopters usually to save down pilots. And I busted my ankle at Fort Benning, so I was recycled through Keesler Air Force Base and went to several schools there, airborne communications, navigations, a basic crypto, 16 weeks of advanced electronics. And then after a full year at Keesler, I was, my first assignment was Cannon Air Force Base in Clovis, New Mexico. And that's where there were two instances that totally changed my career for the rest of my career. One was they had a nuclear, top secret nuclear tester to be used on the aircraft. The ground crew could use it to test out not only the weapon, but the delivery and the, you know, the control boxes and all that stuff. So this chief, and I believe a tech sergeant, had totally screwed up the wiring on this modification of the tester. And that was when they first came out with push-pull pins on Cannon connectors. And people weren't really familiar with it. So they really stripped out the retainer rings in the connectors. So I had this friend, he was a retired chief, Ted West, was a tech rep, a civilian tech rep, GS-12. And I told him, I said, we can fix this temporarily if you get approval. So he went to Captain Sullivan, who was the same colonel I talked about earlier. He was a captain at Cannon, and he was AMS commander, Avionics Maintenance Squadron. So what we did is we basically used super glue and lacing string. Now, believe it or not, they actually used to teach a school for lacing. It's where you take that really fine, flat nylon string that you buy in rolls now, and you would lacing almost like weaving, and we laced up the wires so that the loose ones would be tied to the ones that were in the wires are in there firmly. So we fixed that, and everybody all the way up to the wing commander, Colonel Robert Scott, knew that, you know, this young sergeant at the time had done this. And then towards the end of my, or the middle of my tour at Cannon, I was there a little over 3 years, I went to a crypto school to learn to repair the crypto equipment plus the code boxes. Now, these code boxes were about, oh, I guess about the size of one of those little double-fold cassette holders where it would hold like three layers or four cassettes, and it had sliders on it that were rods. And the daily codes, you would change the daily codes by putting in the codes, letter A through Z on each rod, and then you'd lock it. So when you went out to the aircraft, you could reset the aircraft that morning that was going to fly that day and put the new codes in it. So when the identification friend from foe, IFF transponders, would query another aircraft, the other aircraft could send back the correct codes and they would know it was friendly.
Okay.
So I was looking at the technical maintenance technical order, and it had test codes, had like a whole page of test codes. There weren't actual codes, but there were test codes so that you could put them in the tester and it would work, and you could verify the coder was working. So I got this bright idea in my mind to play a trick on the class, and I memorized these 32 codes, and I challenged the instructor. I said, well, I can just make up a code that'll work, and everybody laughed at me and had some derisive comments that weren't very flattering. So I put my code in there, and he plugged it into the tester, and it worked. And he was astounded. And they really thought I had busted the crypto code. So next thing I know, his chief in there from field training attachment was in there, and I had to do it again. And then they call my commander and said, this kid's the most brilliant thing since the wheel. And then that also went all the way up. Rumors went all the way up to the wing commander. So at some point, the NSA guys knew my name.
Right.
And from Canon on, every assignment I ever had, I was either handpicked or I would make phone calls and I would get the assignment I want. And I could pretty much do anything. I was just like gold plated all of a sudden. I was the miracle boy.
Right. Just by that simple trick of memorizing the 30 codes. That's pretty
cool. Yeah. And the first time the NSA came down, which was a couple of months later, this guy, he says, how'd you do it? And I said, I don't know. It was just, by that time I'd got so much attention, I was afraid to tell him I made it up. I mean, I just copied it, memorized it.
Right.
And when I memorized this alpha 32 alpha codes, I made sentences up.
Okay.
Like A, B, C, D, all boys can do. In other words, I made up several sentences. So when I put the codes in, I just recall the sentences and put the first letter in of each word.
Right.
So this NSA guy, he was very intense. And I told him, I said, well, it seemed logical to me and it was intuitive. I said, I'm really intuitive, which I was. And he looked at me like, man, I'm not buying this crap at all. But they let it drop. And so from the rest of my career, I was involved in one new system after another. I worked the three models of the F-111, the F-15, the F-16, the original B-1, the A-10, all during the heyday of development of these great aircraft. I was on either research and development of the aircraft or the systems on the aircraft or the automatic test equipment that was being built to test the units from the aircraft, like the radar or communications or navigation units. And that all stemmed from those two little things I did at Cannon Air Force Base as a sergeant.
Now, how did you eventually end up at Area 51?
After I left Cannon, I went to Mountain Home Air Force Base, and then after 2 years there, I ended up at Edwards Air Force Base. I was originally supposed to be with Tactical Air Command at the Air Force Flight Test Center doing research and development, flight operational tests and evaluation, FOTNE, on the new F-15. But the Air Force Systems Command had a slot for a shop chief of the automatic test equipment, and back then electronics countermeasures was under automatics. And they actually had a little battle over who's going to get me. So FFTC at Edwards, I got assigned to them.
Okay.
And my boss was a paperclip boy. His name was Franz Dietrich. And he was one of those Germans that they brought over after World War II.
Paperclip, yeah.
And he was there his whole career, I think, until he either died or retired. And we at Edwards, we did a lot of fun things, like we prepped the Streak Eagle, which broke 8 time to climb records. Now, the F-15 was the first jet aircraft that had more thrust than weight. So the damn thing could actually accelerate going straight up like a rocket.
Wow.
And I pulled lots of different PDYs for different companies that were developing avionics units or test equipment for the avionics units. And then when I left Edwards after 3 years, we took all our equipment test stations and moved them to Nellis Air Force Base. Now, that's how I got to Nellis, which has a huge Nellis range that Area 51's part of. So I was involved in a lot of electronic countermeasures and satellite stuff. I was at Nellis. And then at some point, I had this friend, let me back up just here, I had this friend, Dave, Senior Master Sergeant Dave Cassian at Edwards, and he was in charge of all the enlisted people at Groom Air Base.
Right.
And he was in Detachment 3. And a lot of people don't know that Air Force Flight Test Center, FFTC Detachment 3, runs the actual operations at Groom Air Base, Area 51. So the whole time I was at Nellis, he kept trying to get me out there full time at Groom, and I had no interest. I was having a lot of fun traveling and learning new stuff, and I had no interest in being stuck out there in the desert, all week long.
But you're enjoying doing what you were doing.
Oh, absolutely. So at one point, I got a phone call from Wing Commander's office. It was a lieutenant colonel, I believe. And he said, I need your report to this building or whatever. And I believe Cubic, C-U-B-I-C Corporation, was also in that building because I saw some of their flight simulators and stuff that was very interesting. So anyway, this lieutenant colonel says, we need you to go up to a base in the desert and work on some equipment. And he asked me, he says, are you qualified on this unit and this unit? I said, yes, yes. And he says, according to this, you have a top secret Q clearance. So I need you to go up there. And he says, do you have any reason you can't go? Well, I said, no, sir. I said, how long? He says, as long as it takes. So I reported in it. I think it was 4:30 in the morning. We got on this blacking out bus, and we drove from Nellis all the way up Green Air Base. And once you get off the highway there around Indian Springs, depending on which way you go in, it's pretty much improved gravel roads.
Right.
Once you get above Indian Springs and Mercury, it's like I said, it's just all gravel roads. So we're going with this bus, and that fine sand and silt would come to leak through the window. So it was like, the air wasn't that good, I'll just put it that way.
Okay.
And we couldn't see anything, and there was a guy with an M16 that checked our ID cards when we got on the bus, and he was sitting in the front seat, turned sideways, and we were told to shut up, sit down. And we shut up and sit down.
Right.
And I could tell there's probably a lot of people that never been there like me. I don't know. That was just instinctive because, they were trying to see out the front. You could see them keep looking at the front of the bus, trying to see out the front window. And so we got there right before daylight. And we were escorted. There was four or five military policemen with M16s, and there were several of us going to the avionics and electronics building, and they had us put on these black welder's goggles. I mean, that's as close as I can describe them, and you can only see, 50, 60, 70 feet in front of you, and then it got blurred. I don't know if there was some kind of polarization or how they did it, but I'm such a big guy, I have such a big head that I kind of just pull it down just a hair, so when I look down at the ground, I could look over them and I could see around me.
Ah, tricky.
I could have got shot, I guess, but I mean, my curiosity is just, curiosity killed the cat, so.
Yeah.
I went into this building and I was told that I couldn't leave the room. I had to ring a buzzer if I needed help or if I needed to leave the room. So I sorted out. I was looking at the data sheets and the history logs and some of the problems they had with one of the pieces of a crypto, and it was hooked up to a satellite uplink, a docile direct orbital communication link, which was strange to me because it wasn't satellite frequencies or typical coding we would use to transmit or receive information from a satellite. And it led me to believe after, looking at the circuitry and spectrum analyzer and everything else, that they were actually communicating with some kind of vehicle.
Oh, okay.
That you could tell with the equipment if the vehicle was moving away or closer. It's like, you know, radar signals that measure the lapse between two pulses, and they can tell, you know, distance of aircraft. It's very basic stuff. And then when I got into the computer, there was a clock frequency that's like 1 gigahertz, which was just astounding to me because back then.
When was back then? Well, what was the time frame?
I believe it was 77, summer. Did you use 77 or 79? I was up there several times. Actually, I think it was 79. So anyway, I mean, this is a couple of years before the Apple came out, and its clock rate was only 1 megahertz, 1 million hertz. But 1 gigahertz is 1,000 times faster than 1 megahertz.
Right.
So the NSA had a computer, a huge couple of bays, had a computer that had a clock speed of 1 gigahertz. Now, we didn't see 1 gigahertz processor until the, not the 486, it was the first, it was after the 486. What was that?
Before we seen 1 gigahertz? Oh, that's...
Well, no, the 486s, and then they came out with the Pentium 1, I guess.
Yeah.
And it was 1 gigahertz, and that wasn't until, what, 97 or 8?
Mm-hmm.
So that was, you know, 20 years later before the commercials caught up with them. Now, you ask anybody that's ever worked on sophisticated equipment for the NSA, and they'll tell you, which I totally believe, that the National Security Agency's equipment is 20, 30 years ahead of what the public knows.
Yeah, no doubt.
So, anyway, I was working on this stuff, and I needed to get to the other end of the computer cables, which went through a wall to another room. So I rang the buzzer. The guy outside with the M16 opened the door, and I said, I need to go over here and test that cable out. He said, you can't do it. I said, well, hell, the equipment's hooked together. It must be similar. And I said, that's where all the computer information's coming from. He said, write down what you need. I'll give it to them, and they can test it, and they'll write you back. When I could have just walked into the next door of the next large area, you know?
Right.
So, anyway, we got that everything resolved, repaired the equipment, and then the other problems came up, and I was there several days, went back for the next week, and the only reason I actually ended up there the first time was because the guy that repaired the equipment had a death in the family and went on emergency leave, and they had nobody else up there qualified with the clearances that I had.
Right.
So when they call back Detachment 3 saying, hey, we need a replacement for this guy, Detachment 3 says, well, we don't have anybody right now. And then that's when Dave Cassing, Senior Marshal Dave Cassing at Detachment 3 at Edwards, said, I know a guy at Nellis that I believe is qualified on this. And that's how my name got picked.
Right, okay.
So,
okay, go ahead.
So basically, I had first time I ever saw the flying triangle was at Edwards Air Force Base with Jerry Ellerick, and we were on top of the Fairchild A-10 hangar where they were doing research and development on the A-10 Warthog, and it was about, I guess, around midnight.
Now, just to be clear, when you say the flying triangle, you mean what's commonly referred to as the TR-3B, that flying triangle that's thought to be alien technology.
Yes.
But
yes.
But this is a version made by humans, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, originally it was called the TR-3B Astra, but obviously once they get out of testing and go operational, they always change the names of these black aircraft. And the flying triangle is not an aircraft, it's a platform. In other words, it's a flying platform. There is a difference.
Okay.
We'll get into that. But, I mean, I wasn't a science fiction fan that much. And never believed in UFOs, even though I'd heard stories, you know, throughout my Air Force career. So we're on top of this hangar. It's about midnight. And my buddy Jerry points up. He says, that, hey, look up there. I said, where? And he keeps pointing around. I see. He says, there's three triangular lights, and they're getting bigger. And I look. I said, for a while, I'm saying, I don't think so. And then, you know, they slowly got bigger and bigger. This triangle expanded. So the only conclusion we could come to, it was coming closer or coming down in altitude. So finally this thing got to where it was the size of the moon. I don't know the actual distance. I'm guessing maybe 10,000 feet or something like that. And then all of a sudden, this thing just, it took off so fast to the north from Edwards, which had been towards northeast or whatever, towards Nevada. I mean, it's like it jumped, and then it went so fast it just disappeared. So we thought it was some kind of probably classified aircraft, and it never entered our minds it was UFO. Neither one of them said, oh, look at that UFO.
Right.
Because you see all kinds of strange things out in the desert between Edwards and Nellis and Groom Air Base, because there's just a lot of weird stuff up there flying.
Right.
So the second time, we were on our motorcycles, Brian and Jerry and Ray and a couple other kids, I don't remember their names, and it was right at sunset, and all of a sudden this huge, huge shadow comes over. It's like a cloud, a dark cloud will go over you, and you see the shadow on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody hollered, look up. And we looked up, and there was just this massive, massive triangle and sky above us, and it was leaving a shadow on the ground, and it just scooted through the air. I mean, there was no sound, no vibration, no hum that I felt. It disappeared over the next mountain or hill or whatever, and that was it. So Jerry and I had started talking, and we speculated that it was the same thing we had seen at Edwards that night. So it wasn't until I was at Groom, the last time I was at Groom Air Base, Area 51, it was in the evening. No, I mean, it was still light, but it was getting later in the day. And I saw one sitting on the ramp. And my guess is it was the prototype model that was only 200 feet wide.
Okay.
But, I mean, it's like looking at a battleship and saying, somebody telling you, oh, that thing can fly. I mean,
right.
Your mind cannot compute that something that's shaped like a Vicks cough drop that's that thick and heavy looking could fly.
Right. And so, was it just sitting there parked?
Yes.
Okay. Now, did they, how did you get an eyeful of that? I mean, did they let you go over to it or?
No. I was looking over the top of my glasses.
Oh, the glasses that you had to wear. Okay.
Outside, yeah. Now, when they have classified flights, they're posted. You get a data sheet every day saying, you know, they'll say flight X-102 or something, 12 noon. And most of the testing is done at night, so people can't see from the faraway mountains what's really going on. And then they have these huge lights they turn on facing the mountains. So if you're trying to, you know, take pictures of some, it's almost impossible.
Right, that would make it difficult.
Actually, I have a picture Buddy took at Groom Air Base of the early F-117, they call them fog lights, but there's these big, huge, round spotlights they pointed out towards the mountains, and on our website, Alien Scientist forum, AlienScientist.com forum, under my special guest, you can go through there and you can actually see that F-117 with the huge bright lights. So by that time, rumors were getting out, before I left for Okinawa, about these strange triangles being sighted. Right. And this was long before the media caught wind of it. I mean, I believe it wasn't until 1988 that there was the Belgian flying triangle flap.
That's true. Yeah, okay.
So I'd actually been told by my colonel that I could have stayed at Nellis and pulled TDY trips up to Groom Air Base. They liked my work. And, of course, my buddy Dave Cassian gave me glowing reviews for my work at Detachment 3, which is Groom Air Base. But I was ready to get out of there. My wife and I had just split up. We're getting a divorce, and I basically wanted to head to the hills, and the farthest hills were Okinawa.
Ah, okay, so you went out to Okinawa.
So I went and picked Cadre again to Okinawa to field the F-15s in Okinawa, Japan. And later on, I would be transferred to field F-16. I ended up as deputy superintendent with hundreds of people working for me, and my boss was Oscar Seifert. He's retired Air Force now, too. So that was interesting. That's where the trawler experience happened. And a couple of other things I probably go into at some later point.
Actually, yeah, no, I'm going to ask you about that because that was a very interesting point of the book. The character was out in the sea doing a dive. I think it was a recovery mission. And the character, Joe Green, seen a bright light. Now, I'm sure there's more to the story, obviously.
Yes. Like I had mentioned earlier, Rostislav Yukov was the head of the team. We had a large French maritime boat. Our equipment was European, down to our European underwear. So if we got caught, we'd have deniability that we were U.S. military. In fact, if we got caught by or picked up by the Russians, we were on our own. Now, obviously, Rostislav and the crew spoke Russian. And the rest of us knew, like, hi, yes, no. I mean, we were given a real short course and just very, very, maybe 40 or 50 Russian words. That was it.
Yeah.
So, if, you know, somebody asked those questions, we could nod and keep on working and go, yeah, yeah, or, you know, whatever. And so we're out on this boat in the East China Sea, and the National Security Agency had coordinates of where they believe the Russian trawler sank. So we had these grids, and we were dropped off about a mile apart in a triangular grid, and we'd go down with our transponders to about 100 feet, and if we got a lock-on signal, we would drop the transponders. So like I said, when a deep submersible or American submarine came up, they could pick up the signal from the transponder sitting hopefully near the down trawler. So my first two coordinates, I didn't get a lock on. And on my third coordinates, after resetting my unit once or twice, I got a lock on. But the basic story is that I had the wrong colored light, and when I dropped my transponder, that light was still there. And if I put my hand over it, I could still see the light. And then I started thinking, well, either I've got nitrogen narcosis, rapture of the deep, or I was hallucinating. It just made no sense to me. And all of a sudden, I looked at my depth gauge, and I was down 200 feet, which was deadly for a long period of time in the equipment we had. I mean, I was wearing old-fashioned 2080s.
Okay.
Air tanks. And so I kept getting sucked down to the bottom of the ocean, and I dropped my lead weight belt, and I should have started floating up, and I didn't. And I kept going deeper, and I pulled the CO2 cartridges on my buoyancy compensator, which has shot me up fairly fast. I would have ended up with the bends, and then have to decompress me, which they couldn't have done because we didn't have decompression unit on our boat because, you know, if we got pulled over by the Russians and boarded, how do you explain that?
Right.
So either way, I knew I was just totally screwed and would probably die. So the deeper I got, I started this light that was tracking me, standing right in front of me all the time, took off and merged with this huge grouping of other lights. And they strobed and flared up a couple of times. It lit up the whole bottom of the ocean. And next thing I knew, I mean, there was this almost like musical melody in my head, but it sounded like no music I've ever heard before. I mean, it was just euphoric type music. And next thing I know, I had blacked out. Now,
how far down do you figure you were at this point?
My last recognition was over 200 feet.
Okay.
And luckily, the ocean around there is kind of on a plateau. It's not as deep like as a deep trench or something like that ocean.
Right.
So they were supposed to have pulled out by nightfall, but they kept looking for me and decided to stay to daybreak and then pull out in case, you know, my body floated top, something like that. So as they were giving the orders, as Rostov was giving the orders, turn around and head back to Naha Port on Okinawa, southern Okinawa Island. Mike screamed something and dove in the water. And everybody watching him didn't know what the hell he was doing, and then they could see in a distance there was a body floating on the water face up. And my buoyancy compensator was inflated, which kept me on my back. So he grabbed me and started pulling me, swim back towards the boat, and the boat made a turn to get closer to cut the distance in half. And he said I was just talking gibberish, talking about this light.
Oh, okay.
So they pulled me on the boat, took off towards Okinawa, and then Owen McKeon were basically cursing me for screwing up the mission and this and that. And the weirdest thing of all was is my tanks were totally full.
Your air tanks?
Yes.
Now, how the hell can...
It's impossible because it's at the point of my last memory being underwater, my gauges showed that I was on the last bit of my reserve air. Before any of this started happening, I'd already made two coordinates down 100 feet. I was perfectly clear-headed, clear-minded. I was watching my depth gauge, watching my air gauge, but something happened, something just really odd and strange. Now, years later, which I'm still trying to track down, I've got a little information, that there was a UFO that crashed in the same area.
Okay.
And one of my friends, that shall remain anonymous, because he's still alive, thank God, but I call him Dale, said that you weren't there to retrieve a Russian trawler. You were there to lock on to the metal of the saucer.
Oh, that's so interesting.
So our transponders actually had some kind of mass or metal detector or something in them, and we thought they were just regular radio transponders.
And like you said, yours did lock on.
Yes.
Now, that's interesting. How could you be at that depth with having already been to two coordinates and going to the third and being sucked down to that depth? I don't see how you could possibly make it to the surface with that little air.
Oh, I could have probably made it to the surface but I'd had to go up so fast. But on the other hand, my buoyancy compensation wouldn't work, which is impossible because that's like inflating a small inner tube underwater. It's going to push you up fairly fast.
And you continue to go down.
I continue to go down. So even if I'd have made it to the top, even if I'd had oxygen, I would have had to bend so bad. With all that nitrogen in my blood, it would have killed me because there was no decompression chamber.
Right, because you were on a sort of a undercover recovery mission and
exactly
didn't have any identifying labels on your outfits that, you know.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's an interesting event. So where would you go from there? You had that in Okinawa, and you had that event happening. What happened after that? Any events that you would consider strange after that?
Well, right after that, I caught a case of double pleurisy, which is the inflammation of the lining of the outside of the lungs, I believe. And I was in the hospital for a week, and even women that have pleurisy will tell you it's many times worse than giving birth. It's horrendous pain. So I got out of the hospital, and about 3 days later, I was back in the hospital with double pneumonia.
Wow.
And I was so sick they couldn't even airlift me to Hickam Air Force Base in Hawaii to their regional hospital. So I was in there a couple of weeks, almost died. And then after that, I came down with a Ebola-like conjunctivitis. And my eyes turned purple, green, yellow, and they literally looked like prunes. They were so wrinkled.
So the hits, they just kept on coming.
Well, the doctor said, well, you probably got something from the ocean. Because I told him, I said, you know, I've been diving. Of course, I did dive all the time, but I didn't tell him anything about the story, but I just said, you know, I've been diving a lot. And they said, well, there's all kinds of organisms in the water. So, like I said, I had pleurisy and then pneumonia, probably because at some point I was dying of oxygen deprivation, which might have, you know, screwed up my lungs.
They're separate from us. They're a separate civilization.
Well, it was like when they sent Columbus took the original ships to the Americas. I mean, they were half a world away, cut off completely.
Right.
And they took people and started establishing small towns, and some of them didn't make it, and some did. But, you know, it would take, a week, I think, or something to get from England or Spain to North America. And that was no different than back then. The people would hear, oh, we've discovered North America and its endless resources, a bountiful land. I mean, it would be like when we first saw people land on the moon.
Right.
It would have been shocking. Everybody would have been talking about it.
Right. So, but these guys keep pretty much to themselves.
Yeah, but they're explorers. And my God, I mean, somebody says, hey, you want to volunteer to go to the moon and work or go to Mars and work? It's like, you know, you'd kill to have a job like that.
Yeah, and you'd more than willing, you'd be willingly keeping your mouth shut. And, you know, to do something as exciting as that, what are you going to do, jeopardize it by telling everybody at a dinner party that you work on Mars?
Well, not only that, a lot of, I don't want to get into 9/11, but there are some people that disappeared. Because the real story is bullshit. If you had a high-profile person that needed to disappear and you didn't want to kill them, you say, hey, you know, we got this huge moon colony or Mars colony. How'd you like to go up there? And that way you can start all over again. Now, what you got to realize is that when Hal Puthoff ran the remote viewing project at Stanford Research Institute in California, his best remote viewer was a guy named Ingo Swann, who wrote a book called Penetration.
Yep.
Which you can find Penetration on Scribe. In the last couple of chapters, he writes about all the huge facilities on the far side of the moon, which some people call the dark side of the moon.
True. Yeah, I mean, it's entirely possible that this is an absolute reality, that this breakaway civilization exists and there's stuff going on that we just don't know about. And perhaps some of those things we're seeing in the sky that we're identifying as alien technology and alien crafts are human-made back engineering.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, back in the day, maybe in the 50s or something, maybe 2%. Were actual alien UFOs. If you look at all the reports and investigations back then, the military of things that have been released, there were absolutely things that generals like Twining said they're not from Earth and they're visiting us.
Yeah.
But nowadays, since the 70s, 80s, and on, our own space vehicles just keep multiplying. I mean, think about it. Why, when we retired the SR-71, they said we don't need it anymore. We got satellites. Well, that's bullshit because even the KH-11 Keyhole and KH-12 Keyhole satellites the NSA had used hydrogen thrusters, and there was a limitation on how much they could move around. So they came out with the SR-75, also called Penetrator,
yeah,
and replaced it, which has been spotted a number of times around the world. And then I talked about a vehicle called the Scramp, which was the SR-74 that rode on back of the SR-75 up to about 80, 90, 100,000 feet. And then it took off and went into orbit, which is exactly, what is it, the X-37 or 47 now?
Oh, the one that's riding on the back of the other plane that takes off and goes, yeah, okay, got it.
Goes on. So, I mean, anytime they publicly release new technology, NASA's that way. If NASA's saying, oh, we've invented something or we've discovered something or we're going to build this, it's because it's hand-me-down technology.
Right.
It's already been either put in production or rejected.
It's old news. It's old tech.
I mean, I call the space shuttle the old yellow school bus because even when they put up space shuttle, it was old technology.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Okay, have you ever been in an underground base?
I've been in underground tunnels at Buckley Field outside of Denver in the early 70s where they had massive several-story buildings underground, and they built those huge geodesic domes with radar to track movement in space. Right. Whether it was space vehicles or space debris or whatever. And then also at Edwards Air Force Base at the JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory Facilities, that was run out of UCLA Goldstone in California.
Okay. Okay, now are you aware of any other underground bases? Not been in, but aware of.
When I was at a facility called DARK, originally I thought it was S4 because of Bob Lazar's lies, and I've corrected that mistake and admitted I made a huge leap there that was wrong. It went, as far as I know, at least 10 stories underground, and it was massive. I mean, you could see main hallways that would just fade off in the distance.
And is that DARK as in D-A-R-C?
Yes, Defense Advanced Research Center. And that was somewhere south or southeast of Goom Air Base, but it wasn't at Papoose. In fact, there's been geologists and drone engineers and everything else use Papoose and said, you know, there's no facilities there. There's no damn parking lot or buildings on the side of the mountains or vehicles parked around or outside a secret entrance. You know, they'll all just flat tell you it's total bullshit. And the fact is S4 is at Tonopah. It's a radar site.
Okay.
And, of course, all these years, everybody listens to that Bob Lazar, and they go, look, yeah, he was at Papoose at S4. And I said, no, he wasn't. He heard about that because he had a relative working at Tonopah. And he mentioned a classified radar area that was S4. That back then, Lazar told all these lies, hundreds and hundreds of lies, because there wasn't the Internet in 1988. Wasn't the Internet until the late 90s to speak of. So he never thought he'd get caught because everybody would be comparing notes and looking shit up.
Right. So you think this underground base was somewhere else?
No, I think there's an underground base at in or around Groom Air Base, and I had people tell me that there was this tram system, some type of electric vehicle like a train, high speed, that ran from Edwards Air Force Base, North Base, to Area 51, Groom Air Base.
Oh, okay.
Because when I was down in the JPL tunnels, a lot of the side tunnels are only like 20 feet across, mm-hmm. and they would take concrete and flatten out the bottom eighth or whatever to where, you know, where you walk. And they had gas lines, electric lines, all kinds of cables and lines down there. And then there were doors that you need a card, key card, and a personal code that the circular area around the doors was like 30 feet wide. Now, you can get some pretty large vehicles in a 30-foot wide tunnel.
Absolutely. Especially if this thing's, like you said, several layers below the ground. It's a multiple-layer facility.
Well, I had a friend, Dave Lewis, who I work with at Nellis. We're kind of drinking buddies and pool buddies and all that. But he used to talk all the time about his brother being up in Area 51. And he'd see these boring machines that were 30-foot round. They operated them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Excavating underground.
Okay.
The tunnels, and then they'd also run parallel tunnels and then get in there and flatten them out to where they could build, you know, buildings inside them.
Now, Phil Snyder came out and talked about that. He eventually was murdered, but, I mean, he came out and gave a few lectures on that as well.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever, I heard the name. I don't remember. Remember watching his stuff. My problem with ufology, actually it's for the most part ufology, is that everybody borrows everybody's story and says it's mine. Just like when I came out with my book, George, between a couple of them, they knew the story all the way back to the early 50s, where I believe it was either Gravity Ran or General Gravity at Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth, which I believe is where General Rainey was stationed.
Okay.
Of the Roswell incident. So there was one of the oldest guys in the group was pushing 70 by that time. That was back in the mid-90s. Tell me the story that when he was a young MIT graduate and he was at Carswell, that they had pieces of equipment that they were reverse engineering. And he was told it's foreign technology. And, of course, all foreign technology was handled by the FTD, Foreign Technology Division, at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So after a year or so working on this stuff and trying to explain it, this micro-miniaturization of optic cables and circuits that were incredibly small, that they even had a hard time testing them. So at one point, he asked this leader of the group who had kind of befriended him and mentored him. He says, there's nobody on Earth that can make this stuff. And the old scientist, he said, exactly. And he said, well, basically, what are you trying to tell me? He said, I'm not trying to tell you anything. You've already figured it out. So he was cryptic, but he acknowledged it wasn't man on Earth. I mean, there was more to the story, but I just don't remember it. But I did manage to track all the way back to the early 50s where one of the guys had actually worked at, I believe it was Gravity Rand at Carswell Air Force Base.
Okay.
And they were doing reverse engineering. Now, what was the question after that?
The question was about the alien autopsy and your impressions of that.
I got the MJ-12 charter signed by Reagan by proxy. And the alien autopsy from a friend we'll call Dale. And I knew Dale all the way back from late 60s, the Vietnam conflict, and we're also stationed together at Cannon Air Force Base. We didn't work in the same area, but we were close friends. And his father was career NSA over 30 years. So when I was writing the book, I was talking to Dale in detail about the book, and he told his father about the story I was writing. And his father says, well, how well you know this guy? And he said, well, he's basically my best friend. I trust him with my life. So his father says, well, I'm going to give you a couple of documents. It's going to be a lot of stuff blackened out. And you retype them and mail them to him. So that's how I got. I was actually shocked. I had never heard of the MJ or MJ-12 group.
Right. And these are documents that are in your book, Alien Rapture.
Yes. And they're also on our AlienScientist.com forum. You can actually look at even my own personal military documents. But yeah, I was shocked. And what's funny is I was the first one to talk about the removable lenses on the aliens from the autopsy report and the geo organ, which is, we have many organs, but apparently these Roswell aliens had this kind of look like a inner tube shape, small inner tube around. And that's why they call it geo organ. And it functioned as lung, heart, kidneys, whatever. So its physiology was completely, internal physiology was completely different than ours.
Yeah, there's rumors that those removable lenses went into the night vision technology division.
They were obviously external equipment. I mean, things we use as built into glasses or goggles or helmets. They actually somehow incorporated into some kind of thin film, probably nano technology, to where it was like a contact lens, and it just covered the whole eye to where when you people that see these aliens, they've got these dark eyes. So who knows? They could probably see in multiple spectrums, in the infrared, ultraviolet. They could block harmful rays. Who knows? It may even see through things.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
I mean, technology we're just now discovering, or publicly, they were trying to figure out how it worked back in the 50s.
Right. There's other MJ-12 documents out there. Of course, you're fully aware of Stanton Friedman and his work that he's done. Did yours, did the documents that you received match up in any way to what he had?
Yes, other than the fact that we plugged in. A lot of the names were blackened out. And Brad Steiger had actually, my co-author, had actually been with Jamie Shandera and Stanton Friedman and one other guy who revealed the original MJ-12 documents. I think they were sent to, was it Cooper or? But anyway, Brad knew all about the MJ-12 documents. And the names that were missing, he said, well, that had to be this guy and that had to be that guy. And we made a decision to plug in names because otherwise, when people are reading the story, if there's just a bunch of blanks where there should be names, it wouldn't make any sense to them. And I've always admitted that we plugged in the names and one or two dates. In fact, when I originally came out, I posted the original blanked out the way I received it. On Jeff Rentz's show, you can still go to Rentz.com and look up Fouché and find them. Of course, they're also on our forum. A couple of things that struck me as the signed by President Reagan by proxy basically means somebody rubber-stamped that MJ-12 charter behind Reagan's back. Somebody in secret government or whatever you want to call them. But when I read the MJ-12 charter, having spent all those years in the government working on contracts and specifications and organizational charts and all that kind of stuff, the language read totally true to how something like that would have been written. I found no fault in it at all.
Mm-hmm. So there was it did line up with some of the other documents that were out there claiming to be the MJ-12 documents.
Absolutely, but the problem was Stanton was skeptical, but he said on the surface, because I don't have the original documents, it reads like what would have been written about those two subjects. But I met Dr. Woods' son out at Laughlin and offered to send him what I had, and he was extremely rude to me. And he says, if we don't discover it, we don't want to see it. And I'm going like, what a narrow-minded prick.
Okay.
And he was. I mean, you know, he wrote on his daddy's coattail, like other people we know. And, you know, he's not a doctor. He didn't spend 20, 30 years at McDonnell Douglas and stuff like that in high-ranking positions like his father. He just, you know.
Right, okay. So, actually, I'm going to get Charles to ask. Do you have a question about the FAR residents, Charles? Do you want to ask a series of questions, actually? Do you want to ask those?
Well, he's probably going to ask about the entrainment, light and sound technology that Dr. Farr used on Joe Green to retrieve his memories. Now, the CIA has experimented with strobe lights at different brain wave frequencies since the 30s, 40s. And then CIA, one of the things a lot of people don't know is when they had these remote viewers, a lot of time to get them in the right mental brain state, they would use these goggles with the flashing LEDs to change their brain waves quicker. For example, if you have a light and sound machine, I have a Procyon from Mindplace, what I'm using now, you can actually go into a deep theta like a Buddhist monk in 20 minutes, whereas these Buddhist monks spend decades learning how to do it on their own.
Right.
And you can change your brainwave state to learn, to be energized, to focus, to retrieve memories. I mean, it's endless amount of things you do it. And so CIA had a huge hand in it, and the guy Monroe, Robert Monroe, who started Monroe Institute with all his binaural brainwave audio, learned all his techniques from CIA. Just like when I came out with my software NeuralSync, which is a behavior modification software, it also used brainwave audio and video to entrain a person. Now, entrainment is simply the ability of the brain to synchronize with external stimulus, such as certain frequencies of pulsed light or pulsed audio.
Okay. Charles?
Any of the memories that you helped, you know, that you recovered with the help of this technology, are there any that you regret uncovering?
Well, at one point, all of them. But the thing is I started using it in entrainment. My first circuit board, I think, fit in either a 386 or 486 tower computer, and it cost over $1,000. And had a pair of ski goggles with the LEDs and the lens. And the lens was opaque. And I would even, once I got a portable one a couple of years later, which is also very expensive, I used to wear them to bed. And I put them right above delta, which is sleep, and deep theta, and leave them on for hours. And up to that point, I used to have horrible nightmares for years. Many, many years, all through my 20s, 30s, even as a teenager. So I started dreaming dreams that I could actually remember, and fragments started coming out to where when I woke up, not only did I remember my dream, but I actually remembered when these things happened and how they happened. Now, not everything I wanted to learn came out, but sometimes your mind blocks things that might be harmful to you.
Right, go ahead, Charles.
So the technology that the character Farr showed you, that was pretty advanced for its time. Would that be correct?
Oh, absolutely. He had all kinds of different strobe devices he had built, and had monitors that could monitor your blood pressure and your pulse while you were under. And it's not hypnosis. It's actually just reinforcing certain brainwave frequencies. And But yeah, he was the gadget guy. He was a physicist out there at Southwest Research, where he died. It was just amazing to me. Him and Robert Austin, who owns Mine Place, who I've bought all my stuff from over the last 20 years, were way ahead of their time.
What's the most incredible memory that you recovered using this technology?
I don't know if it's incredible, but the most traumatic was all the physical and mental abuse I went through as a child, which I blocked it all. And then that's not something I really wanted to remember. I mean, my biological father was an absolute monster. I mean, he was a very brilliant, successful industrialist, but he was pretty much a raving lunatic drunk from the time he got off work until the time he fell in bed. And, I mean, when I say beatings, I'm talking about things like remembering my father slamming my mother's head down the toilet and fracturing her skull and putting her in a coma. So I'm not talking about slapping or kicking. I'm talking about violent abuse.
Right.
And I was 2 years younger than my brother, but my brother was a lot more traumatized than I was, and he had pretty much broken his spirit. So when my father, even when I was like 6, 7, 8 years old, start beating on my mother or my brother, I would literally throw myself in between them. And no matter what happened, I would take the blame. You know, I got to the point where the beatings were far less severe than the mental abuse. So anyway, yeah, there were memories I really didn't need to clutter up my mind.
But on the positive end of things, were there positive... were there positive memories that come out that were like blocked? I remember you told me a story about when you were a child about sleepwalking.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I mean, I didn't remember that. And also brings up the story about when we used to have a little nightlight kind of lamp. I mean, you know, like a little 5-watt bulb or something in our bedroom because we were terrified of the dark. But one night I woke up and there was this big bear standing about 10 feet from my bed. And I was so scared. You might be able to imagine this. I'm sure you've seen it in movies. You're so scared that nothing will come out of your mouth.
Right. You think you're screaming, but nothing's coming out.
No, I was trying to scream. I remember that. With all my might. And I mean, it would just go like, I mean, it was nothing. So finally, after some point, I actually started screaming and at my mother that there was a bear in the room. And she basically said, I'm going to beat your ass if you don't shut up and go to sleep. So I wouldn't stop screaming. And my brother was hiding under his pillow in the covers, a twin bed next to me. And finally, she says, all right, I'm coming in there. If it's not a bear in there, you're getting a whipping. So I heard her coming down the hall, and that bear changed into a little person for about not even a full second, and then just disappeared in thin air.
So when you say little person, do you mean a short human?
It didn't look human. It happened so fast that for a long time I thought it was like a child.
Okay.
But it was about, I don't know, 4 feet tall. Had a big head, no surprise.
Okay.
And very skinny arms and legs. And as a child, not even ever seen TV or a movie back then. There were no TVs. That was my interpretation, that it was a child. So when I first started remembering this, I realized it wasn't a child. It was some kind of being.
Right. So this was part of the childhood memories that you were uncovering and that were floating back up to the surface of your of the past.
Yes.
Mm, okay. Going back to the far residence and the high technology he had available, he had a concept about ancient civilization interacting with the gods, and did he really believe that this was true? Like, did the person Parr believe what Farr's concepts were in the book about alien civilizations interacting with humans?
Yes,
and the whole bit.
Yes, the real Dr. Farr with an F believed all that and told me all this stuff, pulled out all these books, and I don't think there was hardly any subject the guy wasn't well read on. I mean, you know, he was definitely a Renaissance man. I had never read any of those Chariots of the Gods or Sitchin books or any of those other type books on the subject.
Mm-hmm.
But he was absolutely convinced that modern humans did not come from apes, and that there was a long period of tens, maybe 100,000 years to where apes or other beings or species, the DNA was meddled with. And he explained our junk DNA as parts of the experiments that didn't work, and the junk DNA was no longer used.
Okay, so he, as a real person, actually talked to you about the things that the character in the book were saying. And what was your reaction at the time? He's telling you all of this stuff, showing you books and saying, look here. And I mean, were you having difficulty sort of?
Oh, what's funny is I was raised as a Christian. And even in high school, you know, I went to the Nazarene Church there in Longview and even got married in that church. And after a couple of years in the service, I just kind of got away from the church because I started having all kinds of questions. So the ironic thing was all these doubts and questions I had about my own faith and religion and the Bible, when he talked, I mean, just it answered all of my questions. In other words, it gave me an alternative viewpoint that was logical.
All right, so you weren't sort of thinking in the back of your head, woohoo, this guy's nuts, gotta go, no. Where's the back door, how do I get out of here?
No, not at all. I mean, he was a very calm, deliberate, brilliant person. It's like being able to sit down next to Einstein, have just a friendly conversation and understand what he's saying.
Okay. I get that. No, I mean, you understand why I would ask that, though. I mean, a lot of people would be, you know, might feel uncomfortable around a conversation like that, especially back, this was in the 90s, wasn't it?
It was, yeah, it was either, no, it was in the mid to late 80s. It was before I retired in 87.
Okay, so you were still in the service.
Yes, and I lived in San Antonio, not far from Southwest Research, and I knew his son. And that's how I met him, and we just hit it off. I mean, his son was basically non-technology-wise and had no interest in that. And I think they had a very strained relationship. But even though he was a lot older than me, I just was very attracted to his knowledge. And because, you know, I love technology and science. And when you've got somebody like that that's patient with you, that explains things on your level, and allows you to ask dumb questions, you know, it's like having a mentor in a way.
Yeah, I get that. And you met quite a few people during that time period. And again, this goes to the inspiration for writing the book Alien Rapture in the first place, is these feelings of well, you could call it anger, that the American government was hiding this sort of technology, and that spurned the whole thing.
In 1987, when I retired after 20 years, I was basically medically disabled. I had had heart surgery. Every disc and vertebrae in my back was messed up. My diabetes was out of control. I could go on and on. And when I started writing the book by the early 90s, say 93 or so, or 4 or 5, the doctors basically said, man, you're only going to live another year or two. He says, you've outlived your Dacron graft that they put in your heart. It was only supposed to work for 10 years. You've had it for 30. I had this huge, and still do, aneurysm in my abdominal aorta down near belly button. So I had all these things, and he said, you're a ticking time bomb. He says, it's a miracle you live this long. So I kind of had a fatalistic attitude that even if the government came after me, I wasn't going to live that long anyway. So it was like, you know, hey, I'll get the last laugh. So that's why I stuck my neck out as far as I did. Originally, we were just going to come out with a fiction book and hope people could read between the lines and realize it was true, except obviously the aliens. And right. The ending of the book. But then all of a sudden, you know, I got away with that, and Brad Steiger and Bob Silverstein put together a series of TV interviews, radio interviews, one right after another, some several times a day for that week that I was at Laughlin. The BBC flew over a team of 6 people and interviewed me for like 6 hours. Of course, they only ended up using like 7 minutes of it in Real of the Skies. And then the German TV, which I never saw because it was PAL, did an hour-long special on the Triangle after a long interview with me. And then I did radio shows like Jeff Rentz and Bilbo Shears and a whole bunch of other people and several smaller TV stations and a crew. And then also gave a presentation to MUFON, Los Angeles. So we hit so many places in a week and we've come out with a small publisher that published us because the big publishers wouldn't touch the book.
Which is unusual considering it's, you know, Brad Steiger, and anybody in this field who knows about Brad Steiger knows the guy's written like a ridiculous amount of book, and he's
it's 160, 170 books published, and none of them are self-published.
Right.
And he's had big publishers, and Bob Silverstein was considered the golden boy of the book publishing world. I mean, he did the book deals and movie deals for books like Chariots of Fire. He had never been turned down.
Right.
And they thought, like, this is fishy. We think you guys are revealing classified information. And they wouldn't touch it.
Okay. Yeah, because the whole scene at the end of the book, I'm not going to give it away, obviously, but that was just something that was added. It wasn't a real event, but it was just a perspective.
It was, after talking to Dr. Farr and other people, I made a took literary license and made a jump to a conclusion that this is possibly one tangent that the human race could take to advance us to the next evolutionary step. And like I said, the aliens and the ending is just totally hypothetical.
Right, of course. But now, weren't you supposed to be on Art Bell's show back then?
I was scheduled for Art Bell. Brad Steiger did a weekly show, usually with Art Bell and also Jeff Rentz. And they talked to Art Bell about me twice, sent him a copy of the book. Art Bell said the book was extremely fascinating to him, and he had so many questions for me. And they scheduled me and then canceled. And they scheduled me again a week or two later and canceled me again. And Brad just kept apologizing. He said, I don't know what the hell's going on. He said, it's almost like he'll have all these crazy people on there, but he won't have somebody on there that actually has credentials.
Yeah, and going into that, just we're going to come back to this, but just quickly, you put all of your military records out. When you did the BBC, didn't you show them a whole bunch of your military?
When,
records?
Yes, I had about 900 documents that I saved from the military, and I threw away more than that because they were just irrelevant to anything I might ever need, like through the VA or whatever. And I showed the BBC, MUFON, the International UFO Congress, their whole staff, including Ken Seddon and Bob and Terry Brown, about 200 documents. They showed my security classifications, my training, my medals. I had 3 meritorious service medals, which is good for even a general. And I had 2 commendation medals. I had a Vietnam medal for valor, which is heroism. I had a presidential unit citation, outstanding unit citation, many medals and awards that I was very proud of. And you know, I know people that go through their whole career and get 1 commendation medal and only dream about meritorious service medals.
Right.
So I showed them all that. And what happened was, is the BBC behind my back, I told them, I said, you can't take any pictures of my documents that have my social security number. So while they're filming me, there's one of their assholes had a camera and was taking pictures of documents that had my social security number on. So when they come out with Real of the Skies, my old social security number is right there. They show a document with my old social security number. I couldn't believe it.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, that's why I don't trust the media much.
Yeah. Okay, so that, I just wanted to make that, get that information out there that you had provided your military records to
prove.
Yes,
and I've posted a few select ones, like my performance report that General Doran signed and my civilian performance report at CEA when I was a senior program manager working under Colonel Barry McKeon. He had retired, but he was a decorated SR-71 pilot and a close friend of mine.
Right. So just now that we've set that ground, we're going to go back to the Art Bell interview. Did Brad Steiger eventually contact Art and say, what's going on?
He just said that after thinking about it, he wasn't interested. Which totally baffled Brad. And Brad says, hey, this guy has a document that shows he was assigned to Detachment 3 in the summer of 79, which you well know is Groom Air Base. And Art says, yeah, but we can't prove any of that's real. And Brad says, well, hell, I vouch for him. So anyway, that's it. I really believed after that, and listening to Art Bell for a couple of years, that he didn't want people on there with real credentials for the most part. He had fringe people on there. The wilder their stories, the better.
Right, and it's just unusual that happened. You sort of got blocked from going there. But you had a busy time during that period doing lectures. Your MUFON presentation is up on YouTube, available, thanks to Alien Scientist. A lot of your information's out there. I think your book was even put out for free, wasn't it?
Last I checked, it was on Scribd.
Okay.
I'm currently rewriting it, adding some things that have come back to me since I wrote the book, which explains some of the technology and other things that I wanted to go into more detail. See, the original book, 30% of the book was cut out by the publisher.
Oh, okay.
For one reason or another. So all I'm doing is editing the pre-Blue Line draft that was the full-length story. And I'm going to put it up on Alien Scientist and sell it as an ebook for 2 books or something like that. And so we can generate some funds for Alien Scientist research.
Okay, good, good. Charles, do you have any other questions?
Yeah, how close have you been to alien technology that's either in its original state or back-engineered?
I don't think I've ever seen any technology that was in its original state. In other words, I never saw Star Wars weapons or stuff like that. I saw what the military had that was extremely advanced, more advanced
than what we should have our hands on.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, with that computer, I mean, it was 20 years ahead of its time. Now, most people find that hard to believe. They'll say, well, look at the circuitry. You can see how it was developed, how it got better. Well, yeah, how did it get better? How did it originate? I mean, our technology advances since the 60s. It's just incredible. It's almost unbelievable. Our technology's growing so fast, especially like in the material science with nanotubes and quasi-crystals and other exotic materials. People can't keep up. Even in their own fields, there's breakthroughs every day.
Right, absolutely.
And it's totally unexplainable. I mean, how do you go 50,000 years from the invention of the wheel and you still got a wheel that's being greased with ox fat and made out of wood?
Yeah, I get it. It's pretty unusual. What about? I mean, do you still have contacts in the black ops programs that tell you stuff, or is that just faded away?
Well, hell, over half the people I knew are dead, and I should have died a lot long before them because they were in good health when we started researching the book. And now here I am in the same miserable health I've been all these 30 plus years or something, and I'm still here talking, which just baffles me. So if I had contacts on the inside, I wouldn't talk about it, but I'm not without my own resources.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I was asking there is, are they still giving you information about programs that have been going on? And, of course, that would, at this point, have to fall into the hearsay category. But what is that information that they're telling you? I mean, where would be the state of the technology today?
The only thing I'd bet my life on that I have been told a few things about is that we have a space fleet off the Earth. And, for example, the Flying Triangle was a platform. It was massive. You can imagine the amount of personnel and equipment they could take to the moon or Mars or somewhere, and it's big enough that it could be its own space base or space platform.
What do you mean by massive? How big would that be?
Well, the operational model was 600 feet.
Okay, that's huge.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, you could take enough equipment with you to set up moon bases or build different facilities. Make our space station look like, you know, a little tiny trailer behind your car.
Yeah, it's like a tin can, really. So when Richard Dolan talks about a breakaway civilization, that there are technologies being utilized that are so far beyond what NASA's doing and what they're doing in the aircraft industry, that it is almost like a civilization that's broken away from the mainstream science and technology.
No, I absolutely believe that. I absolutely believe that that has been happening since at least the early 80s, if not sometime in the 60s. It baffles me that so many people don't believe in any of this stuff. There's so much evidence out there.
Right. So they would be, in a way, they would be separate from us. I mean, they certainly can't. I've talked about this before. Who are they going to talk to? I mean, they can't talk to mainstream people. They can't talk to mainstream scientists. They can really only communicate with each other. If they're aware of the advanced technology and the breakaway civilization, they can really only communicate to each other. They can't step outside of that circle.
Well, exactly. The whole time I was in the 12 years I was married to my first wife, she would think I was at a school somewhere and I was on a black program. Because you just, before the fall of the Soviet Union, Nobody talked about anything. In fact, it was illegal to even use the name NRO or NSA. We used to call it No Such Agency.
Okay. What's NRO stand for?
That's the National Reconnaissance Office, and that was classified. So, I mean, people didn't tell their wives. You did your work. It was like a parallel universe, and then you went home once you left work, and you left work at work, and that was all there was to it. You know, wives ask questions, oh, I just worked on equipment all day.
Okay.
Very boring. It was very exciting.
Of course it was. So, like I said, the people in these sort of programs, these very advanced programs, if they're on these platforms or this space fleet that you're talking about, they're separate from us. They're a separate civilization.
Well, it was like when they sent Columbus took the original ships to the Americas. I mean, they were half a world away, cut off completely.
Right.
And they took people and started establishing small towns, and some of them didn't make it, and some did. But, you know, it would take, a week, I think, or something to get from England or Spain to North America. And that was no different than back then. The people would hear, oh, we've discovered North America, and its endless resources, a bountiful land. I mean, it would be like when we first saw people land on the moon.
Right.
It would have been shocking. Everybody would have been talking about it.
Right. So, but these guys keep pretty much to themselves.
Yeah, but they're explorers. And my God, I mean, somebody says, hey, you want to volunteer to go to the moon and work or go to Mars and work? It's like, you know, you'd kill to have a job like that.
Yeah, and you'd more than willing, you'd be willingly keeping your mouth shut. And, you know, to do something as exciting as that, what are you going to do, jeopardize it by telling everybody at a dinner party that you work on Mars?
Well, not only that, a lot of, I don't want to get into 9/11, but there are some people that disappeared because the real story is bullshit. If you had a high-profile person that needed to disappear and you didn't want to kill them, you say, hey, you know, we get this huge moon colony or Mars colony. How'd you like to go up there? And that way you can start all over again. Now, what you got to realize is that when Hal Puthoff ran the remote viewing project at Stanford Research Institute in California, his best remote viewer was a guy named Ingo Swann, who wrote a book called Penetration.
Yep.
Which you can find Penetration on Scribe. In the last couple of chapters, he writes about all the huge facilities on the far side of the moon, which some people call the dark side of the moon.
True. Yeah, I mean, it's entirely possible that this is an absolute reality, that this breakaway civilization exists, and there's stuff going on that we just don't know about. And perhaps some of those things we're seeing in the sky that we're identifying as alien technology and alien crafts are human-made back engineering.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, back in the day, maybe in the 50s or something, maybe 2% were actual alien UFOs. If you look at all the reports and investigations back then, the military, the things that have been released, there were absolutely things that generals, like Twining, said they're not from Earth, and they're visiting us.
Yeah.
But nowadays, since the 70s, 80s, and on, our own space vehicles will just keep multiplying. I mean, think about it. Why, when we retired the SR-71, they said we don't need it anymore. We got satellites. Well, that's bullshit, because even the KH-11 Kehoe and KH-12 Kehoe satellites the NSA had used hydrogen thrusters, and there was a limitation on how much they could move around. So they came out with the SR-75, also called Penetrator,
yeah,
and replaced it, which has been spotted a number of times around the world. And then I talked about a vehicle called the Scramp, which was the SR-74 that rode on back of the SR-75 up to about 80, 90, 100,000 feet, and then it took off and went into orbit, which is exactly, what is it, the X-37 or 47 now?
Oh, the one that's riding on the back of the other plane that takes off and goes, yeah, okay, got it.
Those are, so, I mean, anytime they publicly release new technology, NASA's that way. If NASA's saying, oh, we've invented something or we've discovered something or we're going to build this, it's because it's hand-me-down technology.
Right.
It's already been either put in production or rejected.
It's old news. It's old, old tech.
I mean, I call the space shuttle the old yellow school bus, because even when they put up space shuttle, it was old technology.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Have you ever been in an underground base?
I've been in underground tunnels at Buckley Field outside of Denver in the early 70s, where they had massive several-story buildings underground, and they built those huge geodesic domes with radar to track movement in space, right, whether it was space vehicles or space debris or whatever. And then also at Edwards Air Force Base at the JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory facilities that was run out of UCLA Goldstone in California.
Okay. Okay, now are you aware of any other underground bases? Not been in, but aware of.
When I was at a facility called DARK, originally I thought it was S4 because of Bob Lazar's lies, and I've corrected that mistake and admitted I made a huge leap there that was wrong. It went, as far as I know, at least 10 stories underground, and it was massive. I mean, you could see main hallways that would just fade off in the distance.
And is that DARK as in D-A-R-C?
Yes, Defense Advanced Research Center. And that was somewhere south or southeast of Goom Air Base, but it wasn't at Papoose. In fact, there's been geologists and drone engineers and everything else use Papoose and said, you know, there's no facilities there. There's no damn parking lot or buildings on the side of the mountains or vehicles parked around or outside a secret entrance. You know, they'll all just flat tell you it's total bullshit. And the fact is S4 is at Tonopah. It's a radar site.
Okay.
And, of course, all these years, everybody listens to that Bob Lazar, and they go, look, yeah, he was at Papoose at S4. And I said, no, he wasn't. He heard about that because he had a relative working at Tonopah. And he mentioned a classified radar area that was S4. That back then, Lazar told all these lies, hundreds and hundreds of lies, because there basically wasn't the internet in 1988. Wasn't the internet until the late 90s to speak of. So he never thought he'd get caught because everybody would be comparing notes and looking shit up.
Right. So you think this underground base was somewhere else?
No, I think there's an underground base at in or around Groom Air Base, and I had people tell me that there was this tram system, some type of electric vehicle like a train, high speed, that ran from Edwards Air Force Base, North Base, to Area 51, Groom Air Base.
Oh, okay.
Because when I was down in the JPL tunnels, a lot of the side tunnels are only like 20 feet across, mm-hmm, and they would take concrete and flatten out the bottom eighth or whatever to where, you know, where you walked. And they had gas lines, electric lines, all kinds of cables and lines down there. And then there were doors that you need a key card, and a personal code that the circular area around the doors was like 30 feet wide. Now, you can get some pretty large vehicles in a 30-foot wide tunnel.
Absolutely. And especially if this thing's, like you said, several layers below the ground. It's a multiple-layer facility.
Well, I had a friend, Dave Lewis, who I work with at Nellis. We're kind of drinking buddies and pool buddies and all that. But he used to talk all the time about his brother being up in Area 51. And he'd see these boring machines that were 30-foot round. They operated 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. excavating underground.
Okay.
The tunnels, and then they'd also run parallel tunnels and then get in there and flatten them out to where they could build, you know, buildings inside them.
Now, Phil Snyder came out and talked about that. He eventually was murdered, but, I mean, he came out and gave a few lectures on that as well.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever, I've heard the name. I don't remember ever watching any of his stuff. My problem with ufology, actually it's for the most part ufology, is that everybody borrows everybody's story and says it's mine. Just like when I came out with my book, George Norrie. No, it wasn't Norrie, something like Nagasaki or something, but he came out and adopted my whole story and said, you know, he was a groom and he saw the triangle and he was the first one who knew about the magnetic field disruptor. I mean, these guys, please copy everybody else's stuff.
Right, right. Yeah, that does happen a lot in ufology.
And they completely keep changing their story. My basic story is in the book and my lecture, and I only gave my lecture to the Eye of UFOC in 1999, MUFON 99, once in Sacramento, like late 99. I only gave it a handful of times. It wasn't like I was on the, everybody wanted me on the circuit. Hey, you can sell your books and you can get paid. And I was never paid for any interview, not right. A penny. I mean, I got free lunches and dinner sometimes, but that was it. So I never made a dime off any of those lectures or interviews. Unlike some people won't talk unless somebody pays them a stipend or something.
Right, right.
And I mean, I even had, I won't name the names, but I'm ashamed to say, they would say, well, you got to come back, this or that, and give another presentation. I said, I don't have anything new. They said, well, you know, just elaborate or exaggerate. I said, you're basically saying make up new stuff so you can have me back on your circuit. And I said, well, you know, and that's what they were saying. And that's why you see so many of these guys, they just keep making up more and more stuff.
Right, right.
You know, they start off, they saw a UFO. And the next thing, they test a UFO. And the next thing, they're in a hangar, accidentally, there's a UFO. And then the next thing, it's like, oh, that UFO was sitting at Area 51. But they have no credentials showing they had any military, most of them, or documentation. And I'm telling you one thing about the military, they're obsessive about documentation.
Right.
Every assignment, the length of assignment, who ordered the assignment or gave permission, every training, every bit of training you've ever had, when you permanently changed from one base to another, conferences you went to, your performance reports, your medals, your awards, they're obsessive about documentation. So for people to say, I have no documentation, it's baloney. You can get a copy of your military records, I believe, out of St. Louis.
Yeah. You hear a lot about above top secret and levels above top secret. What's your opinion on that?
Well, I know from 20 years of having top secret Q clearance, which is as high as you can get, that when you have a top secret clearance that authorizes you to work on programs that are top secret, or Q clearance, anything related to nuclear weapons. Now, once you get that clearance, for example, say you're working on the F-117 when it was top secret at Edwards and Burbank and Groom Air Base, you had to get a special access program clearance, which is usually rubber stamp because you're qualified and they need somebody with your qualification, so they gave you a special access program code, which is in your records most of the time. Or you have a secret compartmental investigation that goes along with it. Special background investigation, SBI. I think I made a mistake there somewhere. I don't know where. But anyway, for example, I had a couple of SBIs, special background investigations that also had like lie detector tests or psychological tests. a couple of times. So what you have is you have lateral jobs. The top secret gives you your clearance to work different jobs if you have the training and you're needed in a specific slot. Once you're selected, they'll give you a SCI, I mean a special access program number, and that clears you to work on the equipment.
Right.
So basically, I had several SAPs and SCIs that rewarded me because I worked on different black programs.
Right.
Okay. Even the president has SAPs and SCIs, but a lot of times they're blanket. In other words, it'll be a code that says you're authorized to read information about everything.
Right.
So there is no, I mean, I've heard 20 levels above, 27 levels, 30 levels, 32 levels above. And this is made up by people that have no clue how actual clearances work. You know, it's like deans that I had 32 levels or something above cosmic. Well, cosmic is no different in NATO. That's a NATO term than top secret.
Right.
So when he says, oh, I had a cosmic clearance, everybody goes, ooh, all he's saying is I had a top secret clearance.
Yeah. It's the NATO version of the word top secret.
Exactly.
Okay.
So there's that other myth that goes around and never ends.
The multiple levels of stuff, yeah. And that you can never track my history because all of the stuff that I did is so secret that there'll never be any records of it at all. So I can't actually prove what I'm telling you is true.
Some of the codes I had, the equipment I or aircraft's prototypes and stuff, aren't available on my records. I assume because the plane was never put into production, it just, after that, there was no reference. There was no SAP for that program. So it was just deleted from my records, probably automatically. For example, when I was trying to get my VA disability to cover my health care, I had a Medal of Valor from Vietnam, and I kept telling them I was in Vietnam twice, gave them the months, years. It wasn't part of my records because it was NSA-related assignment. And back then, the NSA wouldn't release any information on anybody.
Okay.
And it wasn't until just a few years ago that they allowed their records of training and jobs to be released. Of course, they redacted anything classified about the job. But most of the time when people write up, for example, your reviews or your medals for promotions or any of that kind of stuff, they know not to write anything that's classified. Okay. But people's whole records disappearing is impossible. I mean, these people say, they deleted my diploma. Why? It's not related to anything classified. Like that liar Burge and Lazar. Or they don't know their professors in their school. Bob Lazar claimed, I went to this professor at MIT and kind of find out it was from Pierce Junior College.
Okay.
And he only took a couple of courses. Where's your pay stubs? Where's your income tax filing showing where you worked or who you work for? Lazar said he worked for the Department of Naval Intelligence. Well, that hadn't existed since World War II.
Right.
Everything on Bob Lazar's W-2 that he showed is wrong, and you can see where it's been washed and retyped. And he was a photo technician, so you know he knew how to do that stuff, even though it was done very crudely. But for a couple of decades, he got away with it.
Right. And Dan Burrish claimed he was had a military rank, right?
He was never in the military. We filed stolen valor charges, several people on him. Then he started taking down all his videos and everything on the internet, talking about him being a captain, and he actually had pictures of him in a fatigue uniform holding a pistol. And the guy's disabled, drawing disability check, but yet he was over there shooting in Iraq. I mean, it's just total baloney. He's the biggest liar I've ever heard in my life. He was never in the military. He didn't get a doctorate degree. Like, it can't, so many people, you can't, all of a sudden they have no records. They don't even have personal records. Like I said, W-2s, income tax filings. By the way, you can get back copies of that stuff from the IRS. Where did you live? Who was your roommate?
Mm-hmm.
Who were your friends with? I mean, it just, it's totally unbelievable that anybody could believe that not only all your government and military records disappeared, but all your personal information disappeared too.
Right. And then we still have this, I mean, Bob Lazar and Dan Burrish, I mean, they're the old versions of that. Some of the new versions are, you know, William Brockbrader claiming he was a Navy SEAL and all of that stuff and, you know, his records and all of that information.
Well, what's amazing is you, mostly you and myself and Dan Benkert and Chief Shipley.
And Charles.
And Charles have all totally debunked this guy, yet he keeps going on and on, and he has a huge following. It's like he's some kind of virus that you can't kill.
Mm. And you actually worked at Area 51, and his claims are, you know, no military records at all.
Well, I actually have posted it's called a partial review. For example, if you're gone more than 30 days to another job, they will give you a add-on kind of a performance review for that short period of time to explain your absence. Now, it doesn't say on there, you know, I worked at Groom Air Base, but what it does say is I was assigned to FFTC Detachment 3, and that is Groom.
Okay, it just goes to show that there's people out there that come out with these claims that don't have any information to back them up, and yet you have, you know, hundreds of military documents. You've got all kinds of information to back up your story about what you've done and where you've been. Plus, you've got insider information as well, and you're naming their names. You're giving their names out. I mean, of course, they're fictional names in the book, but now you've come out with their real names, that these were real people. Charles had a question, and about the TR-3B, and I wanted to bring him in to ask that.
Yeah, late 2010, I had occasion to see a triangular craft fly overhead going north to south, and had I not been looking up, I would have never known it was there. It was absolutely massive. I estimated it to be about 150 to 200 feet, and I had no idea what it was. And, you know, of course, you know, now, having talked to you and, you know, gone over some of your presentations and whatnot, I, you know, fully believe that's a TR-3B. What kind of speeds are they capable of, you know, in our atmosphere? And what kind of speeds are they capable of once they leave this atmosphere?
From what I was told, the operational model, which I never saw, could do Mach 9 in atmosphere. Now, a lot of people said, well, why do they have these multi-mode rocket engines on each corner of the triangle? And a lot of them think that's for propulsion. Well, in atmosphere, they're not used. What you have is you have two nuclear generators that power the magnetic field disruptor that warps gravity by 89%. So you're actually only propelling 11% of the old operational model. I've heard since then that we have achieved total anti-gravity as a propulsive force. I have no facts on that. But if you notice around the triangle, there's these vents. Mm-hmm. And they're vectored intake and thrusters. So these nuclear engines can create thrust out through the ports. Like if it's going one direction, all the ports coming out the back would be thrust, and the side intakes would be for intake air, much like a jet engine. I don't know the details of how it works. The thrusters, multimode rocket thrusters on the corners, are only used in an emergency in atmosphere, and that's why only rarely do you see, when people spot triangles, that the corners are lit very brightly. Now, once it gets into space, anti-gravity only works so much. Further you get away from a gravity source like Earth, the less it's going to work. So back then, they used these multi-mode rocket engines, just like they did on the space shuttle, to give them thrust. are to slow them down when they're, say, approaching a landing on the moon or Mars. And that's why it's called a platform instead of an aircraft, because it doesn't operate as a conventional aircraft.
And what sort of speed could they have? I mean, have you heard about what sort of speed they could attain outside of the atmosphere?
I have no idea, but I would think, since they have the multimode rocket engines for space thrusters, and I've heard of nuclear engines being used in space. I don't understand the actual propulsive concept, but what you've got to realize is that the prototype was being built at least in the early 80s, and I heard there were several smaller triangular vehicles long before that.
Okay.
So God only knows, I mean, since they've been flying the operational model since the early 80s, that's 30 years ago. I'm pretty sure they've got past multimode rockets and have achieved gravity, so it would be, even that would be obsolete. They'd probably use it just for base stations on the moon or Mars, something like that, and just park them and use them for, like, living quarters. And
yeah, who knows where they're at this point? I mean,
yeah.
At this point, we really don't have any idea. You had another question, Charles?
Just that these TR-3Bs could be used to move the type of equipment that they would need to build bases, whether they be on the dark side of the moon or under the surface of the moon or Mars, they would be capable of doing that, right?
Absolutely. And not only that, think about this. Energy source. When you're building anything, you need energy. Well, you've got two nuclear power units in the vehicle that you could tap into the energy. You could recharge electric vehicles, for example. You could provide light. You could provide lighting. I mean, I'm just saying, you have an endless source of energy there.
And you could absolutely transport those. The underground boring machine that you were talking about earlier, I would think that size of this vehicle would allow them to transport that to the moon or Mars or anywhere they wanted to dig these underground tunnels and the areas.
Absolutely. And think about it. Everything would be electric because you couldn't use combustion engines in a near vacuum.
That's true. Okay. Right, so it'd have to be a specialized form of technology to use on those in those areas, right, of course.
Well, like right now, they just released this week a discovery on batteries that will quadruple the energy density of batteries, which will, take a car that can only run 50 miles on electric, and it can run 200 miles, and it's cheaper, and it's not using precious metals like a lot of these other exotic batteries are using.
Exactly.
So God only knows what the military
has had,
had 20, 30 years ago, much less now. I mean, it's like Ben Rich of the Skunt Works said. He says, we have the technology to take E.T. home, which means we can go to the stars. And that guy wasn't a liar. He was probably the most brilliant aircraft designer in world history. And he designed the SR-71.
Right.
And F-117 and classified aircraft that I saw that it's never been released.
Yeah, that's true. They're working on those programs. It's just interesting that that the possibilities of having a vehicle that size and the sort of equipment you could move to other planetary systems like the moon and Mars and whatever the case may be, the possibilities are endless, really.
Yes, and the technology's been there. I mean, if we could put a man on the moon back in the 60s, and believe it or not, it wasn't the latest, greatest technology.
No, it wouldn't have been. I mean,
the space shuttle, for example, the materials and even the avionics and star navigation, all that stuff was off-the-shelf equipment. There wasn't anything really high-tech on the original space shuttle. So, you know, it's deception. Everything NASA does is deception.
Right.
If they've got something they want to release that's not that classified and won't hurt national security, they'll give it to NASA. You know, if they've got hand-me-downs of technology that's 20 years old and they found something better, then NASA discovers it.
They're like the used car. They have like a used car lot and loaded with lemons, you know. That's what they get to play with. Yeah, it's just the possibility is endless of what they could do and what the, you know, where they could be at this point in time. I don't know. Do you have any other questions, Charles?
Just an off the cuff question about the TR-3B. You know, it's capable of going out into space. It's capable of flying around our atmosphere. Is it possible this TR-3B could operate in water?
There's absolutely no reason it couldn't be, because what you got to realize is completely, basically hermetically sealed.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can propel 89% of the weight or mass in space, then underwater you would have anti-gravity, because you also have a natural buoyancy and you could flood different chambers like a submarine and use the magnetic field disruptor to give you propulsion. You wouldn't need rocket engines or propellers. And with this nuclear vectored thrusters, you could take water in the inlets and in front and exhaust it out the back. So this, obviously.
Okay.
Best place in the world to hide these things would be the bottoms of oceans.
Right, right, where you wouldn't get a lot of interaction. Very good point, very good point. Okay, we've gone over our time. You know what, I still have like a couple dozen questions, but we've gone over our time a little bit. And what I'd like to do is, if you have, I know you have a spot on the Alien Scientist Forum, if you could just give out that information on where people would go there, and they could post on the site and you'd answer them and talk to them.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Charles and Scott. It's always fun when we pick each other's brains. But anyway, you can find me, Edgar Fouché, on the alienscientist.com, alienscientist is one word, .com forum. So when you go to alienscientist.com, look for the forum link. Or you can look at my YouTube channel. It's called eFearful, eFearful. So come on over to the Alien Scientist Forum. Scott's a special guest, too, and ask us questions and check us out. And that's it. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. And, yeah, I'll also put a link to your lecture that you did on the at MUFON. That'll also be in the upcoming guests. And the next day, of course, it'll be in the archive. Right. All of your information will be there. People want to go over to the forum, the Alien Scientist Forum, and ask you questions personally, sort of get a follow-up. You're more than happy to answer those questions.
Oh, I try to. I mean, it's rarely I don't answer somebody unless it's just really obscure, stupid things.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your time, Charles. I got to thank you for coming on and asking those questions. I know you put a lot of time and effort into reading the Alien Rapture book, and you got a lot of good questions out of it. So I thought I'd bring you on to ask those questions.
Well, I hope it wasn't that much effort to read the book.
No, I myself read it twice as well. Yeah, it was good. It's an easy read.
Yeah, I'm into my third reading of it now. And it's just a fascinating book, because a lot of the stuff that you talk about in that book is stuff that we theorized 30 years ago.
Oh, you know, that's funny, too. We never even touched on the fact that I talked about exotic materials like quasicrystals and electrochromatic coating and all that stuff was laughed at back then. Now we just got a guy this last year won a Nobel Prize on quasicrystals.
Right, right. Well, you were before your time.
Well, I didn't invent any of that. I just heard about it.
Yeah, I mean, coming out with the information, you were before your time. You know, people weren't ready to accept it back in 96 or 98.
Well, there was no public reference material. People, you know, even scientists. In fact, several years ago, when I first started talking to Jeremy, alien scientist, he was MIT taking physics courses. He's brilliant. He had a full ride, I mean, a full ticket at MIT, which is rare. But anyway, when I was talking about quasi-crystals and some of these carbon composites and electrochromatic coatings and stealth coatings and all that. He didn't have a clue about any of it.
Right, right.
And he had to go ask his professors until, you know, he found somebody that knew a little bit about it, and then he started doing his own research. And he was just blown away that I was talking about this stuff to friends in the early 90s and also in my book in 98.
Yeah, amazing. Well, I appreciate your time, and I know you don't really do a lot of interviews. You probably haven't done one for years, so I appreciate that as well.
No, I did one with Jeff Rentz here a few months back because Brad Steiger practically begged me to come on with him.
Well,
I've got to the point where I don't like Jeff Rentz. We used to be friends because he's so anti-Israel and he's so pro-Islam that, I mean, he's gone off the deep end. I mean, I understand a lot of the things people don't like about Israel, but to condemn all Israelis as being the same would be like everybody comparing Americans to David Duke, the racist.
Okay. Yeah, no, I appreciate your time. I'm glad you came out. I'm glad you talked to us. Getting your information out there is important. I think people should read your book and look into your story because it's fascinating.
I appreciate it. I will continue putting up videos of my earful. I'm going to take down some of the original ones that were horrible lighting and redo them. I'm in the process of doing one now, a two-parter. Charles, have you seen the videos I'm putting up?
I just started watching them the other day, yeah.
Okay. I just want to talk about things from the book since you guys kind of brought it up and Danny's been pestering me and other people for years. The backstory.
Right.
Of me being Joe Green and the personal things happened to me that I've never talked about publicly before.
Right. And some of them we've talked about here today as well.
Yes.
Yeah. We'll definitely do a follow-up because it does sound like there's more information that we could cover. We'll do a follow-up at some point, and I appreciate your time. Thanks a lot, Ed.
You're quite welcome.
And we'll talk to you guys next week. Bye-bye.